Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. And today I have a really distinguished panel. I have my friend Alan Collins, and he is the founder of Student Loan Justice in Washington, D.C., an adjunct professor, Vincent Commisso, here in Albany. I'm waiting for Jim Santa to come on the line. So, Vincent, let's start with you a little bit. It seems that adjunct professors are paid very poorly, and the amount of debt that students are incurring are tremendous. So tell us a little bit about the poorly paid adjunct professors and their lack of unionization.
Sure thing. If you have a problem understanding or hearing me, just stop me and I'll switch off my hair tree back to the phone itself. So basically, over the past 40 years, what you've seen in higher education, public and private schools, but it affects them differently, is a switch from having full-time tenure-track faculty as the majority, approximately three-quarters or so of all faculty, let's say 75%. Today, where that number has dropped to about 25%, and what you have is now about three-quarters of all faculty are off the tenure track and are contingent. Most people know the term adjunct. Some people know the term lecturer. Both are, in most cases, not all cases, nearly all cases anyway, contingent, meaning there's no opportunity for tenure, and there's little in the way, if any, job protections. It's known as precarious labor. Here one minute, gone the next. So one semester I could teach a class. The next semester their class might not be offered, and I don't have a class. Or the class could be put on its schedule. It could get to be a few days before the semester begins, and the class is canceled because there's lack of enrollment or some other cause. And then money I planned on receiving as part of my job has now been sort of pulled out from under me at the last minute, leaving me to scramble with no cost or effect on the institution. So this sort of big switch over the past 30 to 40 years, combined with the fact that the pay for contingent faculty, for adjuncts and lecturers, is pretty paltry. At SUNY Albany, for example, the last I checked, the average was about $2,800 per course to teach for a contingent faculty member. This is spurred all over this is happening all over the United States and beyond, I'm sure, an attempt to, a very good attempt and a good thing, to start unionizing contingent faculty and adjunct professors. We've seen that happen here at a number of schools in the Capital Region. I participated in some of those. And also to push contingent faculty, where they're already part of a union, like at SUNY Albany, to become much more involved in that union and start to, press their demands. So what you're seeing is sort of this pushback against the deprofessionalization of being a professor, an educator at the college or university level.
Now, when did that start?
That's a good question. I don't know the exact history. I know some people who do. But in the past 10 years, it's really picked up a head of steam. In the past, say, 3 years, it really has. It seems that a lot of the work to do this has sort of come out of the Washington, D.C. area initially. And again, I'm open to being wrong about this, but the big push seems to have come out of the D.C. area, where you have, schools like George Washington University, Georgetown American University, who started to organize and, joined with SEIU, Service Employees International Union, to form, to organize and form unions so they could have some voice in their work and in the situation at their respective universities. So that's kind of where it spread out from. And now it's all over the place. You're seeing it on the West Coast. You're seeing it in Boston. You're seeing it here in upstate New York. And for the most part, it's been successful. A lot of contingent faculty, we should say, are already part of unions through the American Federation of Teachers oftentimes. So, for example, in the SUNY system, we're part of United University Professions, which is ultimately under the NYSTED umbrella, New York State United Teachers, which is ultimately part of AFT, American Federation of Teachers. But we're lumped in with other kinds of workers. We're lumped in with tenure-track faculty. We're lumped in with the professional faculty and staff. So we're not our own entity. With what we're seeing in a lot of these other places where SEIU has done the organizing is that the adjunct faculty, the contingent faculty, have formed their own units, independent of other kinds of workers on campus. So their voice there might be a little bit more amplified in that kind of situation. So that's sort of like the genesis of this, as I understand it.
So if this has happened within the past couple of years, and Alan, how long has the student debt crisis been? It's been longer than that, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, the genesis of the student loan crisis, I would say, probably goes back to 1977, actually, when Congress was compelled by Sallie Mae, the nation's largest student loan lender, to remove bankruptcy and other fundamental consumer protections from student loans. But I think similarly to Vincent's comments, the student loan problem really started gathering steam in a big way, I would say somewhere around 1998 or so a little over 10 years ago. And since that time, the national student indebtedness has gone from well under $100 billion, say maybe $50 or $60 billion in 1995, to 20 years later today, over $1.5 trillion when you count home equity and other private loans that are taken out for education. So, but I find it very interesting that at the same time that the universities have been essentially stockpiling cash only since 2007 or so when the financial crisis hit, the contrast between the treatment of the adjunct professors and the books, the profit, not profit, but the unreserved assets on the books of the universities, both public and private, is just stark. It's hugely dichotomous. By my best estimates, the universities have actually managed to stockpile somewhere in the neighborhood of many hundreds of billions of dollars since 2007 in unreserved assets, while the treatment of the adjuncts has, as Vincent said, gone sort of through the floor, and they're treated sort of like Walmart or, you know, McDonald's employees, or even worse.
That's so mind-boggling. So there's a lot of money that's being supported by the universities.
I found it really just sort of to back up for a minute, this story broke maybe 2 or 3 years ago with the University of Wisconsin, where it was found that University of Wisconsin had built up these so-called tuition reserves of some $600 billion. And so the state legislature of Wisconsin was shocked to hear that the university had all this sort of rainy day money laying around. It was unreserved assets that they had built up. And University of Wisconsin responded by saying, oh, well, look, everybody's doing it. And they published something showing all of their peer institutions. And what we found was shocking. University of Texas, for example, had managed to build up some $15 billion in reserves since 2007 or so. And I could go down a long list, but that was It was startling and shocking, especially given that most of the universities have been, you know, screaming that the sky is falling and we're going to have to, you know, turn away students, we're going to have to lay people off, et cetera, since 2007 as a result of, you know, state funding not keeping pace with the rise in tuition price, et cetera. And so when you look at that, you should really have to ask yourself, why are adjuncts paid so horribly when it seems like everybody else that's involved with universities are making out like bandits? The presidents, the coaches, the administrative staff, you know, everybody's doing extraordinarily well, and certainly the tenured professors are doing very well as well.
Benson?
Yes. I'm listening to Alan and I'm processing it all. So all that, without knowing it, feels intuitively right. It sounds right. It feels right. I would say that another sort of factor here, and Alan just talked about it when he mentioned administrators and staff, is that since 1987, there's been a doubling in the number of college/university administrators and staff. So there's been a huge boom in the number of provosts, being assistant to the secretary of the vice provost, these kinds of crazy positions that never existed before. In fairness, just to sort of round it out, there have been a number of new things allegedly, so the universities claim, colleges claim, demanded of schools, right? You know, sustainability initiatives, diversity initiatives, all things that I think people would agree are good. Whether or not schools make real attempts to achieve those things are a different question. But they will certainly claim that they need new offices for these things. But even that doesn't really explain the huge boom in the number of people who do this. Many, if not most of whom, are paid far better than adjuncts and certainly better than much of the full-time faculty. Right? I mean, we're talking six-figure salaries. As far as tenure, and just to sort of say something about full-time tenured faculty, I know many institutions, their wages and benefits have remained frozen or have been chipped away at, just like everyone else in the economy. So, yes, in terms of total compensation, right, wage plus benefits, it is better than most jobs, right? On the other hand, it isn't quite as lucrative as it once was, and it doesn't appear to be improving, my sense of it. So the real question is, where's the money going? Part of it is administration. Part of it, a huge part of it, is administration. But I think what Alan's talking about these cash reserves, are point to something else, and I'm not sure exactly what. We only have sort of, maybe Alan can say more about that, but I know, for example, that, and this speaks to what's the function of the university or the college in 2015 in the United States. We see, for example, that like the biggest landowners in New York City are the universities, NYU, Columbia. They're huge landowners. They're huge property owners. I wouldn't be shocked if this is happening all over the country. We need to start thinking here, sort of take a step back and stop thinking of universities and colleges solely as institutions of higher learning or getting a college degree that somehow gets you a job or something, because that's not really happening either. My students will attest to that. But, you know, what function, what role are colleges and universities playing in 2015 beyond just the official function of educating Americans and students generally, not just Americans, of course? What are its roles? What are its functions? What are its purposes? And then who benefits by it? Who are the winners here? So that's kind of what I'm interested in starting to sort of figure out. I'm sure people are working on this and know a great deal about it. But those are the kinds of questions people should be asking, in addition to the sort of inversion here of going from nearly all or most full-time faculty with tenure and good compensation and benefits 40 years ago to now only a quarter of the people who teach get that. And the boom in administrators, we need to ask, what's the role of the university?
It astounds me that this is something that's, you know, under the radar, and the presidential candidates aren't talking about it. Jim's on the line. Jim, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Sorry for the technical glitches.
That's okay. We've been talking about adjunct professors and the stockpiling of cash that the colleges are doing right now. So tell our listening audience a little bit about what you've done when you were on the Common Council in Albany and how that can have a great effect throughout the country.
Well, you know, it was probably not timely at the time, but it was in regards to the bank bailout. But now it's a whole totally different issue. It's how can we give students relief? You know, I don't think there's a municipality, a town, anything that couldn't benefit from the brain power that we have in our communities. And now it's time to take advantage of that and allow people that volunteer and put in an appropriate amount of time, the same as we do full-time employees, that same benefit of being able to write down or write off student debt for an appropriate amount of municipal service. And I'd like to hear that discussion. I mean, how can you deny, you know, basically free labor, but, you know, the banks, you know, have to sign on, and that's a matter of the municipalities and the government forcing them to do that, because it seems like a worthwhile endeavor, as opposed to, you know, the other discussion you had going on, using and abusing adjunct professors, the same as we've done in public schools for years for substitute teachers, you know, and that's basically what the colleges are doing, you know, using and abusing your staff, you know, at the same as we've done forever with substitute teachers in public schools.
Vincent or Alan, you want to jump in?
Well, I just want to jump in quickly and commend Jim Sannel for what he did with the City of Albany. You know, back before it was even a very important issue in the press, et cetera, Jim recognized very early on and ran a resolution through the Albany City Council calling for some very sweeping changes to the student loan program, including forgiveness and increased consumer protections and others. And I just want to commend him for that. You know, it was something I'd never seen. It jumped right out. And, I mean, this is sort of leadership that I think is really important at the local level, because the student loan problem is really a federal problem. But it really takes local political actions to, you know, if not have the force of law with the feds, at least send a very strong message. And so I was thrilled to see Jim take the leadership on this.
I appreciate it, and I, you know, and look, as you well know, it wasn't my original ideas. It, you know, you'd be commended as well, because a lot of those were your thoughts and ideas, as you know. And what we did was, you know, the end product was how it filtered through the council. The only disappointing thing was, you know, we got a couple nibbles, but nothing really substantial on a federal level. And I just don't understand it, because to me, it just seems to be good business when you can benefit from this brain power and free these people up. The banks would in turn make money on it, because it would free these people to now buy cars and homes. It's basically the trickle-down economy, which hasn't worked for 25 years, but in this instance, municipalities benefit, and in the end result, the banks would too, because you would have that much increased consumerism. So, you know, the theory is, to me, is perfect. It's just a matter of somebody on a federal level has got to really move with it. And I just don't understand, because municipalities would benefit, and the banking institutions would as well in the end, if they could just see beyond, you know, 5 minutes from now. You know, it's all about immediacy instead of seeing the long-term benefit to themselves.
Yeah, if I could just jump in and respond. One of the biggest problems at the federal level with the student loan program is the fact that the Department of Education is looking primarily out for its own institutional interests.
Right.
It has jettisoned the public benefit interest years ago, yeah, if it ever even had it. That's where the buck stops, and that's where good ideas go to die, apparently.
Yeah.
and they have such a lot of things.
You know, I mean, yeah, if they're actually interested in helping people instead of themselves, you know, why can't you, outside of having to go further in debt or own a, you know, be inherited a home, and then have to take that home and refinance. There's really no simple way to refinance student debt. It's the only debt that you really can't, you know, I can move my mortgage around 5 times in a year if I so fit. And here, you know, I can't move my daughter's, you know, student loans a percentage point down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the department is sitting on a $1.4 trillion or over a trillion dollar portfolio. You can't refinance it. You can't file bankruptcy on it. It doesn't have any of the consumer protections that every other loan has. There's no fair debt collection practices. There's no statute of limitations. I mean, almost all consumer protections are gone from this debt. And the department last year booked, or sorry, 2 years ago, booked something like $40 billion in profit on that, which is more than any of the world's largest corporations. And so it's a political problem at this point, and Congress is really the only entity, except for the president, who can really shake things up.
Yeah, and I think if it ever sees the light of day and it gets to a hearing level, like we had in the city council, I wouldn't say that everybody on the city council was convinced that it was even a worthwhile endeavor. And in city councils, sometimes there was the attitude of, you know, why are we meddling into federal and state? It was a matter of, you know, they understood it was impressing people with our opinion and we could become that agent for change. And once we had the first committee meeting and people started coming in from Binghamton, Oneonta, to Express, and as far down as Westchester, coming in with the absolute horror stories. I can remember this one woman, she was probably in her 60s by now. She was a divorced mom, did the right thing, went back to college to improve her station in life, and she did. Success story. She was, you know, really getting her head above water, got in a horrific car accident, darn near died, and wound up falling behind 4 or 5 months on a student loan, so she got herself back on her feet. But now her loans wound up going into like a ridiculous credit card rate of like 21-22%. So on that original $40,000 that she had paid down to 30, she now owed like $70,000, and all of that was ridiculous interest. You know, so I mean, I think once people on a federal level start to hear and those stories more and more start to get exposed, because we certainly only scratched the surface here, that they got to do the right thing. And start to understand, you're right, that all this does is a system that feeds itself and its government at its worst, because it's government perpetuating government and having no useful function but making money for government. And that,
right.
And it's not for, and it's on the back of the people, the very people you're supposed to be helping.
Exactly. Agreed.
Indeed.
but the thing of it is, you know, I had watched the debate the other night, and there was a little talk about reducing the interest rates, but whether you talk about Bernie Sanders or, you know, Hillary Clinton or any of the other candidates, it seems to me, but maybe I'm wrong, they seem to be holding to the big banks, because they're financing, the banks are financing to an extent their campaigns. How do you break out of that?
Well, in my opinion, it starts with grassroots, local level actions, like exactly what Jim did with the city of Albany. It starts with the people, and I don't see really any other path at this point. I think the people have really got to sort of rise up and regain control of the Department of Education through Congress. I just don't see any other mechanism by which we can do that, because the banks are very strong.
Wasn't that what Occupy was supposed to be about?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Go ahead.
You took the words right out of my mouth. And I think the thing is that's said is that if you look at what the banks have done and you go back to 2008 and 2009 and kind of remember that scenario and what was going on, they've taken the TARP funds. So many of these banks have taken the TARP funds and are now using the TARP funds to lobby against the very controls that were put in place so that they couldn't go back and be the reckless gamblers they were and the to prevent another meltdown. And it's unbelievable. So they get bailed out. It'd be the equivalent of any of us going to Vegas, losing our shirt, then being made whole, but being told not to do it again, and people putting safeguards in there, and then asking them to please release us from doing that so I can go and do the very same thing again, expect a different result. It's absolutely unconscionable that they would, be able to take the money that we made them whole, first of all, to get the money to be made whole after bad practices, and then going back and wanting to do those same bad practices and think that this time around it would have a different result. And if it falls on its face, I guess, what's the harm? Because we'll bail them out yet again? Unbelievable.
That's a great point. I mean, right, there's a basic political question that came up during Occupy, right? Back to the Occupy thing, and then to sort of branch out to what you're saying now. A big part of Occupy, what motivated people was student debt. There's absolutely no question. There were other things, too, and a big part of it was trying to show how these things were intertwined and interconnected, and you have a sort of more holistic way of analyzing these separate strands to show how they came together. But back into, during the bailout, you have to, that money was supposed to go for certain purposes, and then it was used for other purposes like lobbying, Congress, the political class in general, to do things that were favorable to the banks, or at least as the banks understood what was favorable to them. But we can't let the president off the hook, right? I mean, it was Ron Huskin who wrote in Confidence Men that when Obama got to the White House, he basically sat down and said the bankers were trembling, right? This is on the verge of when everything's starting to crumble. He said, I'm what's standing between you and the pitchforks, right? But basically, I'm your guy. And so, to the question of what are the candidates saying, where are the candidates, we shouldn't expect, I'm not going to speak to Bernie Sanders, but as far as Hillary Clinton's concerned, it was her husband who deregulated Wall Street and got rid of Glass-Steagall, right? That was back in 1998. Mm-hmm. That was under his watch. Mike Obama, some of her biggest bankrollers are people with ties to Wall Street. So I wouldn't expect her to sort of put the bit in their mouth, so to speak, to hold them accountable or rein them in any meaningful way. Not at least without, a great deal of widespread, organized, grassroots resistance to it. And there's some of this that is shot off from Occupy. There's the Debt Collective, right? They're the ones who are sort of doing what they call a rolling jubilee. Mm-hmm. It's symbolic, but it is actually helping people. They're collecting money to pay off people's debts because, the sticker price for your debt, just like for anything else, is not the real value of what it is. And banks know this. They just want to settle it and move on. So for pennies on the dollar, they're buying people's debt and then freeing them. And it's sort of, literally freeing them from their debt, but it's also symbolic as well of, sort of freeing them now to be free people. Because when you're in debt, you're stuck. And so the bigger question is, how have we gotten to be a society that is so predicated upon debt and then demanding that we pay it back? We're seeing this happen now in Greece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Greece was loaned money over the years that it was questionable whether or not they would have the means to pay that back. It was questionable whether or not the money was going to the purposes that it was supposed to. It was mostly ending up in the hands of, the sort of Greek political and economic oligarchs, not all that different than our own if you really stop and think about it, and not going to the things it was, should have been going to, and now there's this ridiculous demand that they pay the money back. Well, they can't pay it back, so the sensible thing in the past, even 40 or 50 years ago, would have been to write down the debt and engage in massive debt forgiveness. What we see now is, you don't have to pay the debt right now. Just give us some assets. So give us access to, some islands in the Aegean Sea that have, lucrative oil deposits beside them so we can start to drill for oil or some other such thing.
Yeah.
So this is a way of having not just, it's not just about economics, it's about having political control over people, municipalities at the higher level, states, and countries. It fits into a much bigger sort of tapestry here that is finally now people are starting to pay attention to, but there's a long way to go to see how these things are part of that wider field of things going on.
Right. And your point is well taken, and I think, you know, we can get into a whole lot of other larger social issues, and a whole big thing is that so many of us have been sold a bill of goods, you know, and such consumerism. You not only have to have a college education now to succeed, you've got to go to this college, and all the colleges basically are engaging in an arms race. Oh, we got a new athletic field. We got this. Now it's even filtered down to high schools. I mean, I was thrilled to go, and God bless, it's safer and better for the kids. The new, you know, everybody's got artificial turf field. I went to Albany High opening last night, and it's a fabulous facility. I can remember when I started coaching back in 1978, that was absolutely unheard of. Now it's almost commonplace. What, you don't have that? You know, and it's like, and you take it to the colleges, and I said it earlier in a comment when we were texting each other earlier in the week. Colleges are following the same tried and true formula that they've been doing for athletes and using and abusing them forever, where they get out with useless degrees at the end of the day, and they've used them up for their own monetary gain. And they need that, and they have to keep feeding the beast because they have to build another hall. They have to do this. They have to do that. And now look at some of these places that have overbuilt, and then enrollment drops locally, St. Rose, and now they've gone from where they were in a solid economic position and they've fallen down. Or you take Cooper Union in New York City that didn't have to charge tuition to their students for 100 years. And then they go and they renovated. And they went and got money from the bank, and they went and they leveraged, instead of taking the money out and using that money, which it was supposed to do to go to pay the building bonds, they took the money from the bank, floated additional bonds for the building, and then wound up taking the money that they had taken from the banks and investing in Wall Street and lost their shirt. And now for the first time, they went from being a college flush with money to now having a $110 million deficit. That's like, how the hell does somebody not get fired for doing that? Or actually, how do you not wind up in jail? You and I couldn't take a loan from the bank and then go and put it, go to OTB or put it in some other form of gambling, which basically Wall Street is, although it's a little bit more calculated and cleaned up version of it. It just can't fathom, understand people's gall and they're trying to explain that somehow they were entitled to that. It's criminal. It's just wrong. Yeah.
One thing that I might jump in and add here is the fact, and this came out in 2011 or so, as of 2011, over 50%, in fact, about 63% of people walking around with student loan debt that has been used to finance all of the endeavors that Jim just mentioned, 63% are currently unable to pay on their loans. So they're either in deferment, in default, in forbearance, or otherwise delinquent on their debt. So this thing is going off the cliff as we speak. And I mean, the only solution that I can see right now that's tangible is to return the standard bankruptcy protections that, quite frankly, should have never been taken away from student loans. I mean, that's kind of where it starts. That's the only thing that I can see that would actually wake up the federal government to make more judicious decisions about how much money they're willing to lend and to what schools and perhaps even for what degrees and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. That's a great point. I mean, right, 40 years ago, and I can't remember where I was reading about this, right, the sort of idea was the at the federal level and at the state level, we will subsidize, meaning basically pay for, the public university system as a whole. We'll pay for the institution, right? The sort of like larger level, this meta level. By the 1977 they changed the bankruptcy protections. By the 1980s, the whole philosophy had gone the other way around, which was we'll cease to subsidize the institution at the level we once did, and now we'll subsidize the individual In other words, we'll take all the risk off the institution and put all, right, where it's spread out, where it's socialized, collectivized, the public good, well, it's all of us, and we'll personalize and individualize the risk. And that too reflects a whole other set of, that trend in our society, to get rid of public goods, to privatize the risk, and tell people, hey, you know, the arbitrary things in life, if things don't work out, you know, too bad for you, that now it's spread to education. But like Jim said, we've been told a false bill of goods. Everybody is told, right, that you got to go to college. You got to get a degree. What degree, all these things are open questions, and I think we think about college and higher ed in some problematic ways. But none of us are all told we have to go, because that's going to get you a job. Missing out that what we've, again, this other sort of larger trends to keep in mind that are paralleling this, we've seen the shift to a post-industrial, service-oriented economy. Right? Most of the jobs available are, in increasing numbers, are service sector jobs that are not well-paying, with little or nothing in the way of benefits. And the deprofessionalization of many professions. Higher ed is one, K-12 teachers are another, but formerly public goods sorts of things are now becoming deprofessionalized. It's not only in the public sector, it's everywhere. So, when we start to think about it in this broader picture, we have to say there's something systemic going on. There's something bigger than just student loans. Student loans are just sort of a vantage point or an entryway into seeing this bigger picture.
Right.
Because if we start to, sort of pick apart at the thread the student loans, before you know it, the whole thing's going to come unraveled. And that's what I think, that's what the claim was in 2008, 2009, about the if we don't bail these banks out, everything's going to come apart. Whether or not that's true is a different question, but in terms of trying to understand how it all fits together, if we start to really look at it, student loans, before you know it, we're going to have to really ask some hard questions about the nature of work in 21st century America, what functions that different institutions play, what is the government in 21st century America, because it sounds to me like at this point it's at the federal level acting like a protection racket, right? It's extorting money from its citizens in terms of student debt. I don't mean in other things, right? I'm not a libertarian. I don't buy into that. But that it's making money off of its citizens here to finance student loans when they could have just stuck to the old model and financed public goods more broadly and spread the risk out, and we might have avoided this whole thing.
Yeah, agreed.
Gentlemen, we've been talking a little over a half hour, but, Vincent, you raised a thought about broadening out the conversation. Let's talk among ourselves and come up with part two of this conversation. I think it would be worthwhile to do this in segments so we can discuss and we can have a show at another date on exactly this topic, but branching out into different areas of it. Would that be okay with you guys?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. You've been listening to Jim Sano. You've been listening to Adjunct Professor Vincent Commisso and Alan Collins, who is the founder of Student Loan Justice. And we will be talking again, so stay tuned for part two. Have a wonderful day, guys.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you.